I have to say something about war. a little more than I've said. And what I say about, and because I've emphasized the importance of renouncing war and not being a war-making nation, and because it will not be enough to get us out of Iraq. One of these days we'll get out of Iraq. We have to get out of Iraq. We don't belong there, and we're going to have to get out of there. Sooner or later, we're going to have to get out of there. But we don't want to have to. We don't want to get out of Iraq and then have to get out of somewhere else. We don't have to get out of Iraq, but keep troops in Afghanistan, as unfortunately, you know, Obama said, troops in Afghanistan. No, no more. Not just Iraq. We have to get into a mindset about renouncing sort of war, period, and which is a big step. And my ideas about war, my thoughts about war, the conclusions that I've come to about war, they really come from two sources. One from my study of history. Of course, not everybody who studies history comes to the same conclusions. But, you know, you have to listen to various people who study history and decide what makes more sense, right? I've looked at various histories. I've concluded that my history makes more sense. I've always been an objective student of these things, yes. But my ideas about war come from two sources. One of them is studying history, the history of wars, the history of governments, the history of empires. That history helps a lot in straightening out your thinking. And the other is my own experience in war. And, you know, I was in World War II. I was an Air Force bombardier. I dropped bombs on various cities in Europe. That doesn't make me an expert. Lots of people were in wars, and they all come out with different opinions. Well, so all I can do is give you my opinion based on my thinking after having been in a war. I was an enthusiastic enlistee in the Air Force. I wanted to be in the war against fascism, the good war, right? But at the end of the war, as I looked around and surveyed the world and thought about what I had done and thought about and learned about Hiroshima and Nagasaki and learned about Dresden and learned about Hamburg and learned things I didn't even realize while I was bombing. Because when you're involved in a military operation, you don't think. You just, you're an automaton, really. You may be a well-educated and technically competent automaton, but that's what you aren't really, you're not questioning. You're not questioning why are they sending me to bomb this little town? The war is almost over. There's no reason for dropping bombs on several thousand people. No, you don't think. Well, I began to think after the war. I began to think that, and I was thinking now about the good war, the best war. And I was thinking, oh, and then I began to see, no, this good war is not simply good. This best of wars, no. And if it's true of this war, imagine what is true of all the other obviously ugly wars about which you can't even use the word good. And I began to realize certain things that war corrupts everybody. Corrupts everybody who engages in it. They're the bad guys. You make an interesting psychological jump. The jump is this. Since they're the bad guys, you must be the good guys. No. They may very well be the bad guys. They may be fascists and dictators and bad, really bad guys. That doesn't mean you're good. You know, and when I began to look at it that way, I realized that wars are fought by evils on both sides. You know, one is a little more evil than the other, but even though you start in a war with sort of good intentions, we're going to defeat fascism, we're going to do this, you end up being corrupted, you end up being violent, you end up killing a lot of innocent people because you've decided from the beginning that you're right, and then you don't have to ask questions anymore. That's an interesting psychological thing, that you, trick that you play. Say, well, you start out, you make a decision at the very beginning. Decision is, they're wrong, I'm right. Once you have made that decision, you don't have to think anymore. Then anything you do goes. Anything you do is okay because you made the decision early on that they're bad, you're good. Then you can kill several hundred thousand people in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Then you can kill 100,000 people in Dresden. It doesn't matter. You're not thinking about it. Yeah, war corrupts everybody who engages in it. What else can I say about war? Lots of things. You know, people will present you with humanitarian wars. Oh, this is for a good cause. The thing about wars is the outcome is unpredictable. The immediate thing you do is predictable. The immediate thing you do is horrible, because war is horrible. And if somebody promises you that, well, this is horrible, like, you know, we have to bomb these hundreds of thousands of people in Japan. This is horrible, but it's leading to a good thing. Truth is, you never know what this is leading to. You never know the outcome. You never know what the future is. You know that the present is evil, and you are asked to commit this evil for some possible future good. It doesn't make sense. Especially since if you look at the history of wars, you find out that those so-called future goods don't materialize. You know, the future good of World War II was, oh, now we're rid of fascism, now we're going to have a good world, a peaceful world. Now, the UN Charter, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, 50 million people died in World War II, but now it's going to be okay. Well, you've lived these years since World War II. Has it been okay? Can you say that those 50 million lives were, had to be done because of what? No, the wars, violence in general, is a quick fix. It may give you a feeling that you've accomplished something, but it's unpredictable in its ends. And because it's corrupting, the ends are usually bad. So, okay. I won't say anything more about war. Of course, it wastes people. It wastes, wealth. It's an enormous, enormous waste. And so what is there to do? We need to educate ourselves and other people. We need to educate ourselves in history. History is very important. That's why I went into a little history, because if you don't know history, it's as if you were born yesterday. If you were born yesterday, then any leader can tell you anything. You have no way of checking up on it. History is very important. I don't mean formal history, what you learn in a classroom. No, the history that you learn, go to the library. go to the library and learn history. Yeah, we have an educational job to do with history. We have an educational job to do about our relationship to government, and to realize that disobedience is essential to democracy. You see. Yeah. And it's important to understand democracy is not the three branches of government. It's not what they told us in junior high school. Oh, this is democracy. We have three branches of government, the legislative, the executive, judicial. We have checks and balances. We balance one another out. If somebody does something bad, it will be checked by another. Wow, what a neat system. Nothing can go wrong. Well, those structures are not democracy. Democracy is the people. Democracy is social movements. That's what democracy is. And what history tells us is that when injustices have been remedied, they have not been remedied by the three branches of government. They've been remedied by great social movements, which then push and force and pressure and threaten the three branches of government until they finally do something. Really, that's democracy. Mm. And no, we mustn't be pessimistic. We mustn't be cynical. We mustn't think we're powerless. We're not powerless. That's where history comes in. If you look at history, you see people felt powerless and felt powerless and felt powerless until they organized and they got together and they persisted and they didn't give up and they built social movements, whether it was the anti-slavery movement or the black movement of the 1960s or the anti-war movement in Vietnam or the women's movement. They started small and apparently helpless. They became powerful enough to have an effect on the nation and on national policy. We're not powerless. We just have to be persistent and patient, not patient in the passive sense, but patient in the active sense, of having the kind of faith that if all of us do little things, well, if all of us do little things, at some point there will be a critical mass created. Those little things will add up. That's what has happened historically. People were disconsolate and people thought they couldn't, but they kept doing, and then something important happen. And I'll leave you with just one more thought. That if you do that, if you join some group, if you join whatever the group is, a group that's working on, you know, gender equality or racism or immigrant rights or the environment or the war, whatever group you join or whatever little action you take, you know, it will make you feel better. it will make you feel better. I'm not saying we should do all these things just to make ourselves feel better, but it's good to know that life becomes more interesting and rewarding when you become involved with other people in some great social cause. Thank you.
You're listening to a talk by historian Howard Zinn given November 8th, 2008. We'll return with questions from the audience. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Benner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren.
Question from the left and a question from the right. I like that. If you have a question, just speak up.
Thank you, Professor Zinn, for joining us. I was really interested in your discussion of the word we and how it's kind of misused. But I was interested that you still kind of used it. I would tend to talk more in terms of, you know, they have built this empire and they are fighting this war and they never asked us, the real we, what we think. So I was hoping you could explain and make a little more explicit about why you choose to use the word we in the way that you do.
Well, I think I explained that, you know, we're so socialized and so polluted mentally that we keep using these words. We don't mean it. So, yes, even I, as smart as I am, find myself using the word we when I don't mean it, when I mean they. I should have a little signal that comes out from the ceiling that warns me that I'm about to use the word we when I should use the words that they. I mean, of course you're right. And I apologize profusely. And now from the right.
Test. I supported the Nader campaign by obtaining 1,000 signatures, and I want to tell you to petition to get him on a ballot. And I want to tell you, it was an uphill task, even from, met with a lot of resistance from progressives even. Could you expand or at least comment on the relevance of why we need third-party candidates, especially Ralph Nader?
Can I expand on the idea that we need a third party? Is that what you're saying?
I just wonder if you could comment about Ralph Nader's campaign and why it's important.
Why I did what?
Do you agree Ralph Nader's campaign is important?
Oh, do I agree that Ralph Nader's campaign is important? Yes, it's important. I didn't want people to vote for him in swing states where the vote was crucial because I thought it was absolutely urgent to get this gang out of the White House, you see. So in those swing states, you know, I urged people to vote for Obama. I told people, I'd become swelled up with my own importance and I give advice. And so I suggested that if people are in states where Obama is going to no question win, they should feel free to vote their conscience. And the fact is that Nader represents conscience more than Obama does, represents my conscience more. And, these other candidates, including Obama, are thinking, you know, what can I say the right way that will win the most votes? Nader obviously doesn't care how many votes he gets. He'd better not care how many votes he gets. No, man, Nader can just stand up there and tell the truth. Nader is the one candidate with really total integrity. Well, maybe Kucinich. I mean, there are others too. There are other third party candidates, Kucinich, and it's important to respect these people who tell the truth, and at the same time make sure that we take even a small step forward towards a time when the program of these third parties can be realized. Yes. To the left.
Just want to make a quick comment. I drove down here from Ontario today, and on NPR, Daniel Shore was opining, well, Obama needs to move more to the center, which is bullshit. And we don't need that. We don't need that.
I'm sorry. In what you said now, I only heard one word, because that's the way my ear is attuned to hear words like that. But what did you say before? What did Shore say? What did Daniel Shore say? He said Obama should move to the center. If he moves farther to the center, he will quickly be on the right. I like these strategists. Because they're thinking, they're always thinking of votes and voting. You know, they're not thinking about where is the country and where is the world. The world needs more than a centrist solution. A centrist solution will leave us where we are. You know where I stand. I don't use language like that. I'm sorry. I apologize for not using language like that. Yes, on that side.
So all these questions seem somewhat related. So I was wondering, what do you think we should do with all this energy and this activism and this enthusiasm now if the Democrats, as you pointed out, continue to be to the right of the majority of the population? Do we continue to try to make them more progressive, or especially the young voters, abandon them completely, all our money, all our efforts, and go full force to a third party?
Well, I don't think in terms of parties. I think in terms of movements. And so I don't, I generally believe in, and I told this to Ralph Nader. I want you to know I'm on speaking terms with Ralph Nader. the voting arena, the electoral arena, is not the arena for people like you and me. That's not it. And so I wouldn't try to divert people's energy to this party or that party. I think third parties play their role, as I just said. But that's not the important thing. The important thing, you know, is, creating, using this energy that you spoke of, this enthusiasm that you spoke of, to organize people in communities around the country. Look, that's what Martin Luther King was doing. You didn't see Martin Luther King running for office. You didn't see him playing an electoral role. You know, you see him mobilizing people. Before his death, you see him walking with the strikers in Memphis. You see him planning, you know, this tent city across the Potomac, a poor people's campaign. You see him engaging in direct action. That's what you see. And that really is the important thing. And I do believe that thinking about parties, whether it's Democrat or third party, is very much a diversion. I don't mean that, it saps. The electoral system is overplayed and overpraised and saps a lot of energy that could go into community organizing. After all, am I on this side? Yes. It's very, you know, you have to be really smart to know which side you're on. Yes.
Good evening. First off, I'd like to thank you very much for coming here and speaking tonight, as well as all the organizers that helped out with this event. Someone already took my question. It was on independent parties, but it's okay. I'll ask you another one. I'm wondering what your personal thoughts are about anarchy as an ideology. I think in some ways you've suggested that tonight, while also juxtaposing that to some of the positives that the government can do for you. But I'm wondering what your personal, I know Noam Chomsky is a proclaimed anarchist. I'm wondering what your personal opinion is of anarchy as an ideology.
Well, trying to get me into trouble. You probably may know that one of my great heroes is Emma Goldman, who was the great feminist anarchist. Very often people try to categorize me, you know. They approach you and say, "What are you?" They want a one-word answer. It's like, you know, the true-false tests that you get in school. What are you? I say, well, actually, I'm not sure. I'm a little bit of this and a little bit of that. I say, are you a Marxist? Are you an anarchist? Are you a socialist? Are you a communist? Are you a liberal? I say, well, I'm something of a Marxist. I'm something of an anarchist. I'm something of a socialist. Not really a liberal. If a few weeks ago there was the New Yorker. I don't know how many of you read the New Yorker. People in New York State do not consider themselves New Yorkers. But in the New Yorker, a few issues ago, there was some letters. They printed some of the letters of Norman Mailer, who, you know, died not recently. And so there's some of the letters, and very interesting, juicy stuff, because that's the way he was, interesting, juicy. A little nutty, but very smart, and mostly right. He was writing a letter to Playboy magazine, which had interviewed him, and Playboy magazine referred to Norman Mailer as a liberal. And he wrote to them, he said, please. He said, you can call me anything you want. You can call me a socialist. You can call me an anarchist. You can call me a Bolshevik. You can call me an outcast and an outlaw. You can call me anything, but don't call me a liberal. Anyway, I won't go into why. And signing with some, Who's next? I didn't really answer that question, did I? I didn't answer that question. I'm sorry. You simply say, "Oh, I believe in anarchism," well, people will, you know, shudder. Because, you know, there are misconceptions about anarchism, saying, oh, anarchists, they're violent bomb throwers. No. No, governments are violent bomb throwers. You know, there have been some anarchists in history who have been bomb throwers. There also have been Democrats who have been bomb throwers, Republicans who have been bomb throwers. Governments have been the biggest bomb throwers. But actually, most anarchists have been rather nonviolent. You know, Tolstoy, I can say Tolstoy and Thoreau and Gandhi and so there's a misconception about anarchists being violent people. Or no, anarchists don't believe in really. Well, my kind of anarchist doesn't believe in violence or bomb throwing or anything like that. The other misconception is a violent anarchist believe in disorder. No rules, no regulations, do what you want. Smoke if you want to. Well, smoke while not wearing a seatbelt. You know, that's not... No, anarchists just... they just don't believe in centralized government. They don't believe in centralized power, the centralized power of government or the centralized power of the church or the centralized power in the economy. They believe in kind of loose, you know, conglomeration of collectives in the society with real democracy, not the democracy that comes through voting, but the democracy that comes through people getting together, you know, all over and making decisions by themselves. And there are little examples of that in history. Read the history of the Paris Commune of 1871. Read the history in George Orwell's book, Homage to Catalonia, about when the anarchists took over in early 1936, Catalonia, Barcelona. And you see, an order not enforced by punishment, an order that comes out of people's cooperation. Amazing how that can work. Okay. How many more questions? Two more questions. No more. Because I'm about to collapse. Two more questions.
Okay.
Where are we?
Yeah.
Yes.
I was coming from Niagara Falls, Canadian side, and I was put by INS, you know, the immigration service, and I saw a brochure which said, you know, death is not the only way to lose your life. So coming to that and what you said, you know, how we spend the money in war machinery and everything, I'd also like to bring to your attention that we give to Israel billions of dollars to do the same thing, you know, occupy and, you know, do from helicopter bombing. So we have learned that by supporting them. So why that is not in the, you know, people like you should be discussing that along with all the problems what we have of special interest groups.
Oh, I see. You're saying I didn't discuss that. You're right. I'm sorry. You're talking about the Israeli occupation.
Right.
Yeah.
And our money going there.
What's that?
And our money going there.
Oh, and our money going there. Oh, yeah. Huge amounts of U.S. aid to Israel. Yeah. No, the Israeli occupation is a military occupation, like our military occupation of Iraq. And here, too, Barack Obama fell short. I mean, he went even beyond. I mean, granted, he, you know, doesn't want to lose Jewish votes, but not all Jews in the United States support the occupation. You see, Jews are divided about that, and these Jewish organizations, you know, that want to hold on to the occupied territories, they don't necessarily represent Jews in the United States. They don't even represent Jews in Israel. In fact, the majority of Jews in Israel have declared that they believe that Israel should get out of the occupied territories. So And so even from a political point of view, there's no need for Obama to sort of play up to the, you know, the Israeli lobby and the Israeli organizations. No need for him to do that. It's simply wrong. And he should, you know, come out and be honest about it. And he doesn't have to be totally one-sided and say simply Israel is bad and the Palestinians are good. He can point out, you know, that the occupation is bad. Yes, Israel deserves to be secure, and the Palestinians deserve to be secure. No. So, I'm sorry I neglected that. Okay. I neglected lots of things, and I hope you won't bring up any more things that I've neglected. Did I say one more question? One more.
On this side, of course, on this side. Thank you. It's been an incredible week for all of us, and I just want to say thank you for being here tonight. Of all the things to do on a Saturday after the new presidency, this is where I'd like to be, and I'm happy to be here. I did have a question, unfortunately, because you only want two more. I'm going to pass it over to Dan Livingston, but I do have a quick little question after his question, but I'm going to pass it on to him first. A quick little question.
Did you say a quick little question?
Yeah, there's a lot of emphasis at social justice gatherings on extra governmental action, and you did mention that we can be a humanitarian superpower. And I was wondering what your thoughts on because Barack Obama made repeated promises to expand the National Service Corps, like the Peace Corps and AmeriCorps, and I was wondering what your thoughts on the expansion of the Peace Corps and AmeriCorps might be.
Well, I don't know specifically if I would simply expand the Peace Corps and AmeriCorps. The basic idea behind them is good, and they've done some good things, but they also, historically, up to this point, they have been sort of arms of the government, and people who are in those corps have always had to steer in between, you know, doing good things, which those corps, they have done, and being seen as representatives of a government which is not doing good things. So I would suggest that Obama start from scratch. By start from scratch, I mean create a new corps, which is what the New Deal did. The New Deal created the CCC, the Civilian Conservation Corps. And what it did, it gave hundreds of thousands of jobs to young people. Instead of giving them a gun and sending them to fight, it gave them shovels, it gave them maps, it gave them... And these hundreds of thousands of people in the CCC... It's one of those remarkable hidden episodes of American history, but deserves to be recalled. These hundreds of thousands of young people did amazing things.
There are actually conservation corps all over the country that are supported through AmeriCorps. I worked for one.
Okay. Good. Good. I'm not saying anything against AmeriCorps, against the Peace Corps, but I'm just saying that, yeah, this, whatever you call it, the idea of the government hiring and putting to work young people instead of recruiting them into the armed forces and having them do the wonderful things that the CCC did and probably that AmeriCorps has done. The CCC repaired bridges and highways, and they cleaned up rivers and lakes, and they did all sorts of wonderful things for the environment. They built playgrounds and swimming pools, and so there's lots. After all, there's a lot of stuff that has to be done in this country, and people and young people should not be desperate. It's desperation that sends young people into drugs and crime, and that's why we have 2 million people in prison in the United States. Imagine 2 million people in prison in the United States. How many of those people are there out of desperation? As a result of acts of desperation, you see. And so, yeah, we can eliminate a lot of that desperation by creating job corps of various kinds. Yes. Thank you.
You've been listening to a talk by Professor Howard Zinn, author of The People's History of the United States and Other Books. He spoke at Binghamton University November 8, 2008, on the occasion of the first social justice conference organized by students of the State University of New York. We'll conclude the program with the next installment in our serial reading of Power and Powerlessness by Dr. Susan Rosenthal, continuing with Chapter 12, which is titled Suffer the Children. This chapter began with looking at the relationship between the state and the families of those in the lower classes, and how the family cohesion has been intact in order to increase control over succeeding generations. This has its roots in a concept of monarchy, the king as parent to the nation, and the infantilizing of all before the power of the state. Last week, she covered what is called the child welfare system and shown how it has done harm where it purports to be doing good. The system is rooted in the assumption that the poverty of parents is an indication of their unfitness. The underlying philosophy of the present child welfare system is that all families should be able to function adequately without the assistance of society, and that failure to perform the parental role without such assistance is indicative of individual pathology. Those working in social service agencies are overburdened and are encouraged by policy to take children from their families. While some children truly are in danger, in most cases, the most effective means of creating a better life for children is to increase the income of their parents. We ended last week with a telling example. A grandmother and her granddaughter, for whom she was the caregiver, were living in a rented house in Los Angeles, which became uninhabitable when the pipes burst. Instead of finding suitable housing for the family, the child was taken and sent to a foster home, where she died, killed by the foster mother. The state, which refused to spend money to find the grandmother housing, was willing to pay $5,000 in funeral expenses. Social agencies are quick to prosecute birth parents for child abuse while ignoring the more serious problem of foster parent abuse. National data on child abuse fatalities show that a child is twice as likely to die of abuse in foster care as in the general population. A study of reported abuse in Baltimore found the rate of substantiated cases of sexual abuse in foster care more than four times higher than the rate in the general population. State-run group homes and orphanages have a horrific record of child neglect and abuse. A 1997 Los Angeles County grand jury report found that, quote, many of the nearly 5,000 foster children housed in Los Angeles County group homes are physically abused and drugged excessively while being forced to live without proper food, clothing, education, and counseling, close quote. An investigation of all 50 states did not find one that was fully compliant with federal standards for protecting children. The state is an incompetent parent. A 1991 national survey found that 46% of former foster children did not complete high school and 51% were unemployed. More recent studies have found similar results. 30% of the nation's homeless population were in foster care as children. The welfare of children should not be entrusted to a state that impoverishes families and then removes their children, only to neglect, abuse, and abandon them. Poverty is the greatest source of childhood trauma. In the United States, 13 million children and youth live in poverty. 17% of American children do not receive adequate nutrition. The state gives billions of dollars in tax cuts to the capitalist class, while turning children into the largest destitute group in the nation. For this reason alone, the state is the single greatest perpetrator of child abuse. Welfare as social control. In The Children of Neglect, Margaret Smith and Rowena Fong conclude, quote, The traditional view of both poverty and child neglect is that they are due to personal problems of parents and therefore not the responsibility of the community to resolve. Thus, children are condemned to live in poverty because the child welfare system is about the culpability of parents, not about providing resources to resolve the issues associated with poverty. Close quote. The Social Security Act of 1935 entitled poor families to social assistance as long as they needed it. In 1996, the Clinton administration placed a time limit on how long anyone could get welfare, regardless of need. Families that exceed their time limit and become destitute can lose their children to foster care. Ironically, the state pays foster parents twice as much to look after other people's children as it pays biological parents to look after their own children. The Clinton welfare laws also require welfare recipients to find waged work. Most women on welfare are single parents, yet the state provides no funds for child care. In New York City, most of the families investigated for, quote, lack of supervision, had no access to affordable child care. In Genesee County, Michigan, which includes Flint, the foster care population has doubled. One of the main reasons is they're removing children from women forced to leave their children with unsuitable caretakers while they go to jobs they must take under the state's welfare laws. The state won't provide adequate welfare because the capitalist class needs a low-waged workforce, and people won't work for low wages if social assistance is available. Most importantly, the working class cannot be allowed to think it has a right to anything. As a result, the state spends more money to break up families than it spends to keep them together. A 1998 Michigan Auditor General report found that the average cost for family preservation services was $4,367 per family, compared to the annual cost per child of $12,384 for foster care and $56,206 for institutional care. Welfare policies are not designed to help people. They are designed to help the state control the dangerous classes. The threat of losing financial support instills fear and submission in the needy. Funding religious organizations to deliver aid to the poor adds another layer of control. Forcing people to submit to religious doctrine as a condition of receiving support. While welfare policies target the poorest families, the entire working class gets the message. Don't expect any help from the state. Teach them their place. Education as social control goes back to slavery days, when it was a crime to teach black slaves to read and write. By the time slavery was legally abolished in 1863, more than 95% of blacks were illiterate. Newly freed slaves were hungry to learn. Few were too young and none were too old to make the attempt to learn. As fast as any kind of teachers could be secured, not only were day schools filled, but night schools as well. Day school, night school, and Sunday school were always crowded, and often many had to be turned away for want of room. Teachers flooded down from the north. However, the southern establishment tried to block their efforts. Quote, in the interior of Texas, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, Kentucky, Tennessee, and Maryland, Negroes were disposed of their school buildings. Teachers were not allowed to enter upon their duties, and churches and schoolhouses were sometimes burned. Close quote. The black civil rights movement won the legal integration of public schools in the 1950s. However, the employers' offensive has eroded that victory. As the courts lifted desegregation laws and attacked affirmative action, the proportion of black students attending integrated schools dropped. In Chicago today, almost 90% of public school students are black or Latino. In The Shame of the Nation, The Restoration of Apartheid Schooling in America, Jonathan Kozel explains how education funding policies perpetuate a race-segregated school system. Education is funded primarily through property taxes, so schools in poor neighborhoods are starved for money, teachers, books, and other resources. Because of racism, blacks and Hispanics are more likely to live in poor neighborhoods. A vicious cycle is created, where black and Latino children are deprived of educational opportunities that could help them get better-paying jobs as adults. The education system is designed to keep all working-class people down. Before industrial capitalism, young people learned by watching and listening, by exploring the world on their own, by apprenticing themselves to those who had something to teach them, and by trial and error. This kind of learning, directed by curiosity and embedded in society, is incompatible with a work system that demands repetitive movements and unquestioning obedience. In The Underground History of American Education, John Taylor Gatto explains that the modern school system developed in response to working-class rebellions that shook capitalism in 1848 and again after World War I. The ruling class needed a school system to keep the masses in their place, working for capitalism. This was no secret conspiracy. President Woodrow Wilson announced, quote, "We want one class to have a liberal education. We want another class, a very much larger class of necessity, to forego the privilege of a liberal education and fit themselves to perform specific, difficult, manual tasks," close quote. To preserve the class system, schools teach children only what they will need to do their future jobs and no more. A few creative critical thinkers are needed at the management and professional level. However, the majority are expected to work in low-waged, mind-numbing jobs. These students cannot be allowed to develop their potential. William Torrey Harris, U.S. Commissioner of Education, between 1889 and 1906, writes approvingly, quote, 99 students out of 100 are automata, careful to walk in prescribed paths, careful to follow the prescribed custom. This is not an accident, but the result of substantial education, which, scientifically defined, is the subsumption of the individual, close quote. The de-skilling of work has been accompanied by a rising rate of illiteracy. Based on American military testing, 98% of adult men could read or write in the 1930s. By World War II, this number had dropped to 96%. During the Korean War, the literacy rate declined to 81%. By 1973, only 73% of recruits for the Vietnam War had a minimal level of literacy. Literacy rates have fallen faster for whites than for blacks. Between 1940 and 1992, black illiteracy doubled, while white illiteracy quadrupled. A 1992 nationwide survey conducted by the U.S. Department of Education found that 21% of the adult population did not have basic reading and writing skills, and 8 million people were unable to perform even the simplest literacy tasks. A 2003 survey found that prose literacy among adults had fallen at every level of education. Is the school system failing? In Dumbing Us Down, The Hidden Curriculum of Compulsory Schooling, John Taylor Gatto quotes David Albert, "Schools are not failing. On the contrary, they are spectacularly successful in doing precisely what they are intended to do and what they have been intended to do since their inception. The school system, perfected at places like the University of Chicago, Columbia Teachers College, Carnegie Mellon, and Harvard, and funded by the captains of industry, was explicitly set up to ensure a docile, malleable workforce to meet the growing, changing demands of corporate capitalism," close quote. In Savage Inequalities, Children in America's Schools, Jonathan Kozel explains how working-class youth are denied education. Schools in more affluent areas can hire the best teachers and provide the most engaging learning experiences. Schools starved of funds cannot feed hungry minds. In some states, the difference between rich and poor schools is more than $2,000 per student per year. The U.S. has one of the highest high school dropout rates in the industrialized world. Only two-thirds of all students and only half of minority students graduate from high school. In New York City, only 18% of students and 9% of black students qualify for admission to college. These statistics are the results of a school system that preserves racial and class inequalities, providing just enough education to prepare children for their predetermined roles in society. Youngsters naturally resent such unfairness. Kozel quotes a high school student from the South Bronx. "Most of the students in this school won't go to college. Many of them will join the military. If there's a war, we have to fight. Why should I go to war and fight for opportunities I can't enjoy, for things rich people value, for their freedom? But I do not have that freedom, and I can't go to their schools." Close quote. What did you learn in school today? In 1964, Tom Paxton wrote, "What did you learn in school today?" A song that describes how schools create a distorted view of the world. History lessons highlight the deeds of great men and ignore the contributions of regular folks. The message is that ordinary people have nothing to offer society. 11-year-old Oliver Maynard Langendyke recounts his experience. Quote, "I came into school and most of my friends had their backpacks on. I asked them where they were going and they told me it was a special kids' trip to this comic book convention. The principal selected them. Most of them had something special about them. They were really quiet or they were really, really smart. I don't know. No one told me how they got to go. It made me feel left out. The other kids who didn't get to go felt the same as me. I was really mad, so I told my mom. Some other parents were mad, too, so they all went to the principal, and he said he wouldn't do it again, but they did." Close quote. Oliver is learning that some people get special privileges and others don't, and that you're not supposed to question this arrangement. He's learning that people in authority do as they please, that they cannot be trusted, and that parents are powerless against them. The school system is designed to teach these lessons to working-class children. A few students, those who seem eager to please the authorities, are groomed for professional training. The rest are channeled into low-paying jobs. To prepare youngsters for life under capitalism, schools must discipline children to obey without question, think and do as we say. Pressure children to conform to external expectations. Be who we want you to be. Accustom children to competition. Fight over the crumbs we throw you. Grade and sort children into categories based on future functions. Adapt to the needs of the machine. Groom a few students to manage and control the others. Workers need managers. Degrade and humiliate the rest for not being good enough. You don't deserve better. Schools teach dissociation. To accomplish the tasks listed above, schools must remove children from sources of independent learning. Huck Finn did not attend school, and look at the trouble he got into, freeing a slave and all. Homework ensures that children stay busy with school-directed chores. For most children, school attendance is compulsory. There is no choice. Schools claim to help children fulfill their creative and intellectual potential. In practice, most schools are run like assembly line factories without regard for students' needs. Government-mandated programs and standardized testing demand that every child learn the same thing at the same time in the same way. As one Los Angeles principal told his teachers, quote, "When I stand in the hallway, I should be able to hear all fourth grade teachers saying the same thing. Do not deviate from the scripted program, and do not fall behind in the pacing plan, close quote. To condition them for the workplace, students are trained to obey the clock. Bells ring periodically to signal a change of station. At the ring of the bell, students must drop what they are doing and move to the next classrooms. No thought, conversation, or project can continue beyond the time allotted. When concentration is continually interrupted, only now matters. Repeated disengagements of this kind teach children not to think too long or care too much about anything. Television reinforces the immediate and the temporary. Politicians appreciate voters who don't recall past betrayals. Schools promote dissociation when they divide subjects into arbitrary categories with no seeming connection, divorce facts from their historical context, and make no effort to relate material to the child's world. Large numbers of students in each classroom keep teachers busy enforcing discipline instead of responding to students' individual needs. Schools teach children to rely on and take direction only from experts. Students confined in age-segregated classrooms can neither learn from older children nor teach younger ones. They must sit quietly and not talk to one another. Only the teacher is presumed to have anything important to say. Students are not allowed to speak, to move from their seats, or to go to the toilet without permission. Big Brother surveillance reinforces authoritarian control. In 2002, three-quarters of the 950 new public schools that opened across America were equipped with spy cameras. Continual electronic monitoring of classrooms and corridors sends the message that youngsters cannot be trusted. Schools enforce the rules that govern male and female behavior. Males are shamed for being quiet or emotional, while females are shamed for being loud or aggressive. Males are groomed to act tough and disdain everything female, while females are pressured to look sexy and defer to males. No ambiguity is tolerated. Rigid sex role expectations keep children focused on their performance. The more they censor themselves, the less they relate to each other in genuine ways. These rigid sex roles that are reinforced throughout life block compassion, prevent intimacy, and contribute to marriage breakdown. Schools teach bigotry and intolerance. The Human Rights Watch publication Hatred in the Hallways, Violence and Discrimination Against Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, and Transgender Students in U.S. Schools explains how more than 2 million school-age youth in the United States, who are different from the majority of their peers, soon learn that the principle of equality does not apply to them. In one Iowa school, gay students reported hearing anti-gay epithets about every 7 minutes. The report condemns the abject failure of the United States government to protect lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender youth who attend public schools from harassment and violence. Government, at the local, state, and federal levels, has refused to dismantle laws and policies and to eliminate the practice that effectively discriminate against these youth. Close quote. I've been reading from the book Power and Powerlessness by Dr. Susan Rosenthal, published in 2006. We'll continue with the reading next week. In the meantime, you can obtain the entire book in various ways through the author's website at susanrosenthal.com. Over the coming weeks, we'll be reading the book together, and at the end, I'll be interviewing Dr. Rosenthal and asking her my questions and yours if you'll submit them to me. If you have questions and comments about the book you'd like her to respond to during the interview, please email them to me at the email link on the Unwelcome Guests website at unwelcomeguests.org, where you can also find MP3 downloads and podcasts of this and all previous episodes of the show. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening.